From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made over a 9-month stretch starting in the spring of 2015. Parents and child care providers, pediatricians and school leaders had all raised concerns about the quality of care regarding children's social and emotional health, and not just in schools. And so the Greater Rochester Health Foundation's Commission on Children's Behavioral Health in the Finger Lakes was convened to take a look at the issue and maybe find ways to better provide services and enhance what's being done now. What did they find? Well, here's one important point. In any given year, between 13 and 20% of children between the ages of 2 and 18 experience a mental disorder or issue of some kind. And the prevalence of these disorders does appear to be increasing. But why? One possible reason is the high incidence of trauma in kids' lives. According to the report, an overwhelming number of children in our region witness or experience trauma-inducing events. And right now, there's a shortage of providers who can work with early childhood groups. So we know those years can be critical. This hour, we explore their findings and their ideas for perhaps what we can do next to help with behavioral and emotional health in our children. Our guests include Dr. Martin Lustig. Marty is a Senior Vice President and Corporate Medical Director for Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, and he's co-chair of the Greater Rochester Initiative for Children's Social and Emotional Health Implementation Task Force. Dr. Lustig, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Anita Black is here. Anita is a program officer for the Greater Rochester Health Foundation. Anita, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sean Nelms. Sean's the superintendent of East High, and he's co-chair of the Greater Rochester Initiative for Children's Social and Emotional Health Implementation Task Force. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Let's just kind of start with some definitions here, because we're going to talk a lot about social and emotional health. And I guess, Dr. Lustig, we'll start with you. When we talk social and emotional health, broadly speaking, what do we mean?
So it's a more interesting question than it might appear on the surface. Actually, a subset of our task force spent a fair amount of time trying to make sure we had some alignment and clarity in the definition. And I'll tell you, even as a pediatrician, the training and background in pediatrics doesn't solve the problem of clearly defining kids' social and emotional health. What our task force came up with was really based on work that's been done, 5 critical attributes that assure that kids will be healthy socially and emotionally. That includes self-awareness, self-management and self-regulation, relationship skills, social awareness, and responsible decision-making. Personally, I try to sort of simplify that myself, looking at it from a typical adult's perspective, that kids need to grow up in an environment that's safe and supportive as possible, that maximizes their ability to be successful in relationships in the family situation, in the school, both with their peers and academically. Those are really the major tasks that children face, and they need to be supported to be healthy socially and emotionally in order to be successful in those.
Sean, as superintendent of East, when we talk social and emotional health, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think Marty really captures those 5 competencies well: self-awareness, self-management, relationships, skills, social awareness, and responsible decision-making. But in a school setting, we're really looking at fostering clear relationships with students and their parents and the community that serve them, ensuring that schools are a caring, safe environment, and making sure that we foster sustained and predictable healthy habits and routines for students. And in schools, it really is important that the whole child is educated. And often, those who serve the children are not always on the same playing field. So making sure there's a coordinated effort between those who serve students and the students themselves, and ensuring that we have healthy environments for those individuals is paramount in K-12 schools.
Anita, when it comes to why this whole sort of initiative came together, you go back to 2015, what was going on? What happened?
Yeah, well, we started hearing from parents as well as teachers, providers, about the intense needs that kids were having across different settings. So child care providers were expelling kids from their programs because of difficult behaviors. Parents were expressing concern and need around that. Teachers having difficulty because they recognized that the behaviors in their classrooms were more than they could handle, and they didn't know what they could do about it. So the foundation convened, commissioned a group to come together to kind of discuss what was happening and what was going on. There were surveys and focus groups that included community members and providers and stakeholders. And that's really where the crisis and care report was born out of, which really indicates the gaps in access, capacity, quality of care for kids across the region.
If you don't mind, you know, our listeners are hearing some terms that are kind of, you know, they're kind of umbrella terms, they're a little abstract. And I think it's helpful that some of the work you were able to do was talk directly to families, sometimes parents, sometimes young people, to understand exactly their experiences, just to give some examples of the challenges and in particular what trauma can do. So I'd like to read a little bit from what you were able to find. No last names, just some first names. And I think that'll give us a peg to kind of talk about, well, certainly trauma, and then what else you were able to sort of diagnose through this and what's going to happen next year. So here's an example of a young woman named DeMaurice, and she was 10. It says, by the time she was 10 years old, DeMaurice had experienced enough trauma to set the tone for her teenage years. Her mother died when she was 8. She had already spent 4 years in the foster care system in New York City. She was brought to Rochester into a household of constant conflict. In fourth grade, she was suspended for a week for fighting in school. I blame myself, she says, because my mom died when I was little. I don't know how to express my feelings. I get angry too fast, sometimes about things that I shouldn't be angry about at all. She was sent to in-school counseling for the remainder of the school year and saw a counselor outside of school as well. Counseling helped. I became much calmer, she reflected. I still have anger issues now, but not to the point that I would go off. After 4 years in a hostile home environment, she moved in with an aunt with whom she has a much healthier relationship. And while self-aware and with a much improved disposition these days, she's 16 years old. She still has an individualized education plan that states she is emotionally disturbed. She's placed in smaller classes, which she likes, and explains she is still working on her anger and other emotions like trust. She has friends now, but says the worst part of being unable to control her anger is, I've lost a lot of people because of my attitude. And when asked what she hopes for the future, she pauses and then simply says, I don't know, to get better. Sean, how often do we hear stories like that?
Every day. And that's a sad reality. And DeMaurice is not someone who is, she's not the exception. She's more the norm. And I'm not saying that every child in RCSD or in our schools are facing that type of trauma, but that brought me to this table. Those examples and situations where the school was faced with the task of supporting families and students. And often we only contact those that we know about or that has proven effective in the past. But in that effort, we forget about the other networks of support that are available in the community. And so this task force, one of their main goals is to make sure we create a network of support and we educate those who are serving students, like schools, in ways that our social workers and counselors and teachers and principals know where to send students so that the only social-emotional support they receive is not in the school day. Because students need to be supported on the weekends, over the summer, and over breaks. And there are tremendous resources in this community, but I don't think we do a good enough job of coordinating them in a collective impact type of way. And so DeMaurice, I can substitute her name for about 1,000 other kids. And the work that Marty has done and Anita has done and the team of individuals that we work with on this this task force has really opened my eyes to the myriad of opportunities that exist and how I can better serve our school community as its leader.
One interesting side to what Sean's talking about is, so I came into this from a completely different angle as a pediatrician, you know, working at a health plan who sort of has the healthcare lens on all of the problems that I see, and getting exposed through the commission's work and now through the task force to see all of the different stakeholders at the table who actually, as Sean was saying, there's a lot of resources out there that are available to help kids and families in these situations, but there's a tendency for each subset of those resources to only see the world through their own lens, and we don't have historically very good connections among them, whether it's between the school and the community-based resources or between healthcare and other resources or healthcare and the schools. And that is one of the areas we're focusing on by bringing all the stakeholders around one table to begin to build connections among us. So one, we have a common language. We were talking about the definition and how much work it took to get all these different people around the table to use similar language to even talk about the problem, but also then to build really operational bridges so that we can provide a better safety net for kids.
You want to add to that, Anita?
Yeah, and I would say I think her example and her story and the context that she put it in really shows that, you know, we may see the child as sort of the presenting issue, the presenting problem, but there's a fundamental need for that child. There's a fundamental need for that family who is trying to work through the multiple systems that that child would be moving through in order to get all their needs addressed. So there becomes an additional burden on families that really sectors need to pay attention to, so that families can engage in a way that feels comfortable for them and the access is easy. And that really ripples out into the community. The education system gets taxed. The education system alone can't handle a situation like this. It really does ask for cross-collaborative support and an interplay between sectors to really bring the resources needed for children and families.
If I can just give one more example, and this is something I worked on yesterday with a group of social workers, a student, his now guardian, and folks at this table. There's a student who, with his permission, I could share this story, at 14 entered the probation court system and has really fought to turn himself around. So take a kid who was making poor decisions in his neighborhood, turned around, became a straight-A student, honor roll student, and preparing to go to college. 2 weeks ago, his mother passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm. And in his home were his two younger siblings, he and his mom. And so within 24 hours, this kid was faced with a myriad of decisions. He had to figure out housing for he and his family. He had to figure out how he was going to feed his siblings. He had to bury his mom. He had to work on transportation to and from college now and to and from school. He talked about his own trauma and stress and not wanting to finish high school because that was the last thing his mom asked of him. So finishing high school is a closure to his mom's life. He viewed it that way. He had to look at things like the prom and having enough money to buy his clothes. And so when we think about healthy environments and trauma and behavioral health, it's not just the death of his mom, but it's the ripple effect that prevents and creates tremendous obstacles and barriers. And again, I think what I appreciate much about this task force is with one call, I was able to think about and brainstorm with a group of individuals who said, for housing, try this agency. For the prom, try that agency. For his own social emotional health, try this agency. And for his siblings, you might want to go here. And that's where this work becomes really important. We create this cocoon and this network of support around kids in ways that we haven't seen in the past. And we're working towards that. But I think about that kid every single day and the many obstacles he has to face just to graduate in 3 weeks. And making the decision, do I now go to college and leave my two younger siblings in a condition that is that's unknown? And that's where schools really struggle. And we rely heavily on community support to help us make the best decisions with those families, with those kids, so they can have a productive life. Or we know if we don't, they often tend to make other decisions that are unhealthy.
Well, and you know, we heard Marty mention the importance of even just defining terms, behavioral and emotional health, and you know, kind of creating these 5 points and helping really get a real working definition of that. I want to talk about how we define trauma. I think about the way, you know, emotional health can be impacted. And trauma, sometimes we assume trauma is violence related or you know, those kinds of scenarios. But I think the story of Michael gives you a perspective on how things can break down and how you have to wonder if certain things are traumatizing. For example, this is somebody who's never had a consistent caring adult presence in his entire life for more than any short amount of time. Does that lead to trauma? So let me read Michael's story and we'll talk more about how we define trauma. Michael admits he is not living the life he wants. He strives for something better, but just doesn't know how to suppress, quote, his demons. Michael has been diagnosed with ADHD, depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. He's also never had a consistent, caring adult presence for more than a short period of time. I've literally never had anyone stay in my life, he says. I had to learn everything on my own, and at times I was homeless, sleeping in the rain or in a shed. I'm still stressed, still grieving, and I don't know how to express it the right way. Not knowing how to express his feelings led him to violence and substance abuse, behaviors that kept him from earning a high school diploma and earned him a police record instead. When Michael was sent to jail for burglary and assault, he was without medication for 2 weeks until the system could process a request for a doctor and the doctor was able to visit and evaluate him. But the consistency of prison got him thinking about his future, and he began working toward his GED with the hopes of getting his life on track. Then, his brother died of an enlarged heart, and his mother died a month later. This new grief again derailed his sobriety and his plans. Michael has now been meeting a psychiatrist regularly for nearly 3 years and goes to individual and group therapy weekly for his chemical dependency. And although this counter-appointed treatment provides some consistency, Michael struggles with mixed messages and advice coming from the different systems with which he's involved. One person will tell me one thing and the other says something else, he says of the mental health and addiction specialist, adding, the judge wants me to do something else too. It makes me crazy. My needs are not being met and I have no connection with the therapist. I get into my own thoughts and shut down and I want the pain to go away fast. That's when I want to use drugs again and make it all go away. Michael's greatest wish is to successfully move past drug court, to be successful and, quote, get a real decent job. But the reality, he says, is that may not happen. Every chance I get, he says, when I know I'm going to cross the finish line, something holds me back, end quote. This is someone who, I mean, Sean, there's got to be a lot of points you can there and say, that is legitimately, this is a traumatic experience, this is a traumatic. How do we define trauma, and what can we learn from this story?
Well, again, I think, there are all types of trauma. There's vicarious trauma. There are kids who experience it secondhand, and it's not directly happening to them. There's a thing called the prevalence of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. And ACEs it measures 10 types of trauma around physical and sexual and verbal abuse, physical and emotional neglect, a family member who's been depressed or addicted to alcohol, students who may witness their mother being abused, losing a parent or separation. And this ACEs survey says that when kids have at least two of those type of indicators, that they should be seen. I mean, every kid should be seen, but at least two, there should be a mandated treatment. What often happens is that we're not aware of those. Kids don't come to school necessarily and say, yesterday my mom was beaten, or my dad came home drunk, or whatever those scenarios are. And so schools are often faced with dealing with students without knowing the true nature and root causes of their problems until it's too late, until they're in a probation setting, or they're in chemical dependency, or they self-medicate. And so what I seek to do as an educator is to create an environment, and I know other districts are doing the same thing throughout the county. This is not a city problem. It's to create an environment where students feel safe and comfortable expressing themselves in ways that reveal some of those negative factors, and then allowing us to connect them with other agencies to address it. The last thing we want to do is to find out that a kid is struggling from these adverse consequences or adverse experiences when it's too late. And for many of our students, that's when we find it out, when they're already in the court system. And nearly two-thirds of every adult have at least one of those adverse childhood experiences. And so we know this is a prevalent problem. I think that trauma is not new. I think that the medical field has become smarter about it. I think schools have become smarter about identifying when students are struggling. I think the next step in that is, now how do we coordinate support in ways that prevent a kid like Michael from making those decisions or being diagnosed when he's already in the court system?
Anita?
Yeah, I really just want to piggyback and reinforce what Sean was saying. Trauma doesn't discriminate, right? So trauma can occur to all kids at any point in time in one way or another. It really depends on the circumstances and the environment and the child's own resiliency, but we're understanding that it's more common than not. So if we know that it's happening across economics, geography, race, and ethnicity, we as providers, as systems, as sector-serving children, really need to consider how do we address, approach, support children and families, knowing that trauma is a part of life for most of these children. So I think that's part of what the Implementation Task Force has been having conversations around in our Trauma Response Work Group. How can we help systems and sectors and professionals become more trauma responsive so that we can serve those in need much better than we are now? You know, these meaningful improvements that can happen.
Dr. Lustig?
Well, another challenge along this line is that because many of us who serve children have not had adequate training and support in these issues, it's not uncommon for adults in their legitimate roles interacting with kids, when the kids do experience these adverse childhood events and are traumatized, that we can make their trauma worse by the way we respond if it's not what we call trauma-informed care. So it's another major issue that the task force has identified and that we're working to find ways to expand training and support for adults who interact with kids so that there's so that at least we aren't making it worse.
What's an example of how trauma-informed care will make sure you're not making it worse and you are being sensitive and making it better?
So I don't want to pick on anybody, but what easily comes to my mind is the way that law enforcement might interact with a child in the midst of a crisis where something happens and they arrive on the scene. And, you know, whether they come across as threatening to that child in the way that they might ask them questions as a witness versus being supportive and sensitive to the fact that the child is in the midst of a traumatic experience. And you know, there's a lot of variability in, the level of training that somebody in a role like that might have to actually, you know, it's one thing to have intuition, but to actually have been trained on how do you interact with someone who's in a crisis like that to make sure that you're not making it worse?
And, you know, that's a kind of leads to where I was going to ask Sean Nelms, superintendent of East. You know, Dr. Lustig brings up law enforcement. Again, not to pick on law enforcement, but just to point out that in these sensitive situations, sometimes an officer that might not have that kind of training might respond in a different fashion. And there's a real kind of fork in the road. Can we make it better? Can we make it worse? Mm-hmm. I wonder about discipline at school. Yep. You know, if a child is experiencing emotional and behavioral challenges as a result of trauma, that may manifest in school. And our listeners may be wondering, you know, do you think a zero tolerance, real sort of tough discipline, tough love approach is more effective, or a restorative practices approach is more effective, particularly for kids who've been through trauma?
Well, we adopt a restorative practice approach at East, and we've seen tremendous results from it. And restorative practice is not the anti-suspension drug. It is it's a process in which we restore relationships between and among students, between and among staff, and between students and staff. And you do that by breaking down the barriers that exist when you're in a dictatorial, authoritative state. And you say, you think in a different way. If we think about addressing the root causes by hearing voices equally and then developing a plan to address whatever those root causes are, as a school community, we're much better off long term. And so we've seen suspension rates drop by about 75% because of
the
restorative
practice. Just in the last year or so?
Just in the last year and a half.
Year and
absolutely.
A half.
So when we first entered East, there are about 3,000 suspensions for 1,600 kids. Nearly 25% of the kids got into at least one fight the previous year. So imagine a school setting of 1,600 kids and 400 different kids getting into a fight that year. Like, that was East. And we knew that suspension wasn't going to solve that. We knew that changing students or staff wasn't going to solve that. It was about redefining our school culture and expectations and holding ourselves accountable to it. And there are many different examples of schools who are adopting a more trauma-informed practice. I think about the work being done in Greece in Wheatland Chailai High Schools, where they are working with social-emotional learning teams to support social-emotional work. There's family counseling being offered out in the Finger Lakes region to support some of our rural schools. Excellus has been very proactive in working with primary care providers to understand what leads to anxiety and depression and ADHD and aggression. And then at East ourselves, you know, we talk about restorative practice, but we also partner with the Villa to support mental health wellness. So restorative practice is definitely the way to go. Zero tolerance has not worked. We know it does not work. In situations where kids are violent or unsafe in suspensions, that definitely has to be applied. But the real challenge is, how do you mediate situations in ways that prevent kids from having the same outcomes? Then another critical part at East with restorative practice is every single staff member was trained, including our school resource officer. So the who was a RPD officer, and he was trained in how to de-escalate students to get to the root causes so we can have a conversation from a common point. And so it's not just about teachers. It's the support staff. It's the individuals who get on the bus and ride with the kids in the morning. It's the bus monitors. It's the lunch individuals. It's really a community-wide initiative. And if we can take that type of approach and replicate that throughout Monroe County and the other counties surrounding Monroe County, I think we'll be much better off as a greater Rochester community.
One follow-up on behalf of some of the listeners who might be more skeptical of this kind of approach. When you got there, again, 1,600 students, roughly a quarter, 400 being involved in fights in the previous school year. And some will say, okay, well, just because suspensions are down doesn't mean kids aren't fighting at the same level.
Absolutely. So I will tell you that we also track minor altercations. Okay. So suspensions could be subjective, and I think that's a credible point. I think that there are times we could have suspended we didn't, and times that we did that we should not have. But you can't argue minor altercations. And that in itself has dropped by nearly 80%. The number of kids who physically fight per population, you can do it by number, you do it by percent. The kids just aren't fighting. And they don't want to be in a dangerous environment. And fighting is a very traumatic experience. To be punched or to punch someone is not something that's a natural human instinct. And creating a culture where students are encouraged to talk out their aggression, to come to common terms, and to be proactive in their approach to doing so has proven well for us. And I'm really excited to see where East is headed. But I'm also encouraged by the work being done in other area schools as well as they seek to approach a more restorative approach to supporting their students and their families.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back with our guests and talk more about what they have been finding and where they think we're going next in this region when it comes to behavioral and emotional health. We're talking to Dr. Martin Lustig, who is Senior Vice President and Corporate Medical Director for Excellus BCBS and co-chair of the Greater Rochester Initiative for Children's Social and Emotional Health Implementation Task Force. You just heard Sean Nelms, who is the superintendent at East High. He's also co-chair, and Anita Black is program officer for the Greater Rochester Health Foundation. Let's get that break and come right back. Okay, I'm Evan Dawson.
There's a million different ways we can go, but I'll just sort of follow
Kevin Williamson is a conservative writer for National Review who defends newspapers like the New York Times. He says it's poisonous to dismiss news simply because we don't like it. We're going to talk to journalists with the Democrat and Chronicle for their perspective. Then in our second hour, the story of our community bikes and a preview, the Western New York Bike Fest. It's all coming up Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to remind you why we're here with this panel this hour. The Greater Rochester Health Foundation's Commission on Children's Behavioral Health in the Finger Lakes convened in the spring of 2015 as a way to kind of address concerns raised by parents, child care providers, schools, pediatricians, and children's mental health clinicians, focusing on quality of care at a lot of different ages. I mean, we're not just talking about early childhood. We're not just talking about high school. We're talking about sort of across the spectrum and not just in schools, though certainly that's a big part of it. But it was addressing sort of every level of where care can be improved, where response can be improved, prevention. So we're going to get to some of what they have found coming up. I want to read one listener email that came in from Patrick, and Patrick wants to know. He says, Evan, just wanted to know, did your panel study medication, how much kids are medicated? I keep hearing that we over-medicate kids for depression and other things. Was that part of it? Good question, Patrick. Dr. Lustig?
Yes. Oh, interestingly, as part of work that we've done with local pediatricians and pediatric psychiatrists, we looked at our own data on this, and it does show a significant trend of increasing use of medications for behavioral health diagnoses in kids over the last 5 years, as well as increasing number of visits to pediatricians that have a mental health or behavioral health diagnosis as part of that visit. As someone who goes out and talks to pediatricians pretty regularly, it is very common to hear them say over half my practice is now behavioral health related, which is just another indication of what we talked about at the beginning of the program of how prevalent these problems are and how much that prevalence has increased over time.
Just want to let you know, listeners, that the report itself is pretty accessible, and we're going to post it on the podcast page for this program later today on WXXI evndawsonnews.org/connections. You can also get it on our Twitter feeds, at Evan Dawson. We'll post it there, and producer Megan Mack at MMack Media if you want to check it out. You hear about a lot of reports like this. Again, this is more accessible, so kudos to you guys for at least making it really digestible from a community perspective. And Patrick, thank you for the question. I want to talk about what collaborations are actually happening. Before we're done here, we should be talking about what's going on, what listeners can do, and sort of what prevention and response, maybe the changes or what we're learning about that. But Dr. Lustig, let's start with collaborations. What's actually happening as a result of the work that you guys have been doing here?
Sure. So I'll speak to at least one of them that I've been directly involved in. As I just mentioned, we actually started last year and are now in the early stages of a project that's a collaboration with pediatricians throughout the Rochester region, along with child psychiatrists. There's an organization called CAPPC. It's Child and Adolescent Psychiatry for Primary Care. That's been in existence for a while, and we used their resources and capabilities and are bringing together this collaborative project that's really focused on training pediatric practices throughout the region to make sure that they have consistent skills around screening children for behavioral health problems and early intervention for those problems. What are, you know, how do we make sure we're screening well, we're making correct initial diagnoses, and if they need treatment, that we're doing the most appropriate treatments, really reduce variability in what's likely to happen to kids who are at risk and having problems. So we're really proud of this. It's looking at it again through the healthcare lens, but given the needs that are out there, really trying to strengthen the capabilities of the pediatric network that we have out there. We have great pediatricians in the Rochester region, and taking advantage of that and giving them added support and training, we think is going to make a big difference. So we're using our own data as well as hopefully data from the practices themselves to track the impact of this over the next couple of years.
Sean, I think when I hear the stories of collaboration, and you mentioned earlier the importance of being able to say if there's an issue related to mental health, if there's an issue related to prom, if there's an issue related to medical, that you know where to kind of go with this. It's the same kind of theme we hear with the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. There's a lot happening in our community. Are we able to tie it together? What do you see coming out of this effort here, tying together, especially when it comes to emotional and behavioral health?
Well, and that's why I really commend those 25 plus agencies who are part of this initiative, because the work is already happening. And we look at the prevention lens and what's happening with those groups, and Anita could speak to that, and also then the trauma response lens. I mean, we are talking about more practical things like a pamphlet or a booklet that aligns and identifies the different types of agencies that are out there that can support issue X or issue Y. I mean, just sitting around the table with these providers has opened my eyes, and this information has been brought back to various districts. Again, we already see the impact happening into suburban districts and rural settings, and because it's information that we all want. It's easy to, once it's created, people are yearning for this. They're yearning for this work, and I really thank the Greater Health Foundation for convening these groups of individuals to truly move this forward. And it should not live within those sitting at the table. And that's one of the major points of this, is it has to live outside of that group. And you'll see a lot of that work happening in the upcoming months and year.
A big difference, Anita, is prevention and response. I mean, response is responding to an issue that already exists. Prevention probably starts at early ages. But what did this work shed light on when it comes to how we can better prevent some of these challenges?
Yeah, and it's interesting. We've had a lot of conversation, and actually the community's had a lot of conversation about the impact of trauma, and becoming more trauma responsive in some ways does both of those things. It helps kind of address when trauma issues show up, but it also is an approach and action that we can take to sort of look at preventing re-traumatizing children. So, you know, trauma response is very much about realizing the impact and prevalence of trauma, and having that understanding so that when a child does have a behavior in a school, that we're not sort of looking through a narrowed lens of that kid's a problem kid, but taking a wider lens of what happened to you and how can I help you. Recognizing those signs and symptoms is important for the child as well as those who are working with the children. Sean brought up vicarious trauma. For those mental health providers, educators who work in situations that are full of traumatic situations, that can have an impact on them too. So looking at the vicarious trauma and the caretaking that those who work with children also need. And then responding in a way in the moment, but also responding as sectors with engaging more in the beliefs, policies, and practices that our organizations have around being trauma-informed. And that's where the Trauma Response Work Group really wants to push out further and kind of inspire change within organizations over the next several months, and inviting organizations to learn more about becoming trauma-informed and taking a deeper dive at their beliefs, policies, and practices. And there are tools out there that we've been discussing that could be helpful for organizations, like a trauma-informed organizational self-assessment or a checklist for a school. So that's some of the work we hope to bring forward over the next few months. And it's really like climbing on board the movement and the momentum that's already happening in the community, and we want to push that even forward.
All right, let me grab a phone call. This is Sam in Rochester, first up on the phones. Go ahead, Sam.
Thank you for taking my phone call. I used to work with one of the school board representatives, and we were doing research on the suspension when why they were so high. And we found out that a lot of those kids who were suspended were born drug addicted. And they were just acting out from the symptoms in which they were born with. But the teachers in the classroom didn't know why they were acting out. And it was confidential, and they couldn't reveal to them. And so the teacher would wind up suspending the child, and it wouldn't be the child's fault. It's just that the teacher or the child wasn't given the proper medical medicine that it needed to counteract those things that was being done and said in the classroom. And at that time, they was not recognizing those children that was born drug addicted. You know, it's a personal thing. They couldn't, you know, tell everybody, and it couldn't tell the teachers. So, I guess my question is, are they doing anything now that when a child is born drug addicted and come into the educational system, who is informed that the child could have a problem, and how are they reacting to it?
Those are great points, Sam, and thank you for the comment. I believe you've captured it quite well. I think that's the purpose of this work. There are huge disconnects between schools and service providers, and this task force, this challenge to the community, is to be more coordinated in our approach. I don't need to know that a student is drug addicted for me to be able to support a kid. But what I need to know is, how might I support this student based on their current status? So each child should have an advocate. Those advocates are service providers sometimes they're local clergy, and sometimes they're schools. It's when we don't talk and share information is when we see huge gaps in support for our youth. And so in an ideal state, that child's advocate would have said to us, this particular student prefers sitting at the front of the class. They need frequent breaks. When they start to stand, they're about to enter into an episode. And we can function in the classroom from that state. It's when we are not aware of how to even support the student is where we see a breakdown. And so I think that there is a huge call for us to increase the number of social workers in schools and counselors, and also to coordinate better with our service providers so we can not talk about what's wrong with the kid, but really focus on what happened and how we support them moving forward. And with the work you've done, Sam, and you're dealing with this issue, I appreciate. But there are many different scenarios where we can apply that concept and theory too. We must coordinate ourselves, and the trauma task force is focused on just doing that.
Yeah, and we need to know something about what the problem is in order to work with the child. Because I found out they did more in protecting the child than addressing the problem that the child had. And then the child would go through the system and would get out of the system and would continue that kind of activity even outside the system because he didn't get the necessary help that he needed when he was younger. And not being his fault, but being what he was exposed to when he was a child. And there was no help for him.
Well stated.
Yeah, Sam, thank you for the phone call. Let me read an email from CT, who says, Evan, a whole show could be done on the shortage of care in this area. Kids with trauma often end up at Strong's Adolescent Psych ER Center, which is woefully understaffed and lacking beds, and the Adolescent Psych Center lack any training on reactive attachment disorder or PTSD. I don't know if that's accurate. I'm just reading CT's email, but Dr. Lustig?
Yeah, so a couple of comments about this. One is clearly, again, this is not just a healthcare issue, but healthcare is certainly a critical piece of services that need to be available. Part of what we experience in child behavioral health healthcare resources is that there's a national shortage of pediatric psychiatry. So in part of the reasoning behind the program that I described that we're doing around training pediatrician is we know there aren't enough pediatric psychiatrists to provide all the care that's needed for all the kids who are suffering from behavioral health diagnoses. So expanding the capabilities of our pediatric community is, from our point of view, the most logical way to try to meet some of those needs. But this is not just a local crisis from a healthcare point of view. This is a national problem. But I also don't want to miss, and probably Sean and Anita can comment better than I can, that this isn't just about psychiatry services. This is about all the other services that kids need. And do we have the capacity and capabilities to meet all their needs? Do we have culturally competent care in each of those arenas?
Yeah, go ahead, Anita.
Yeah, I was just going to add that it really goes back to your question, Evan, about prevention, because there is a lot of emphasis around treatment, which is needed, and it's essential. And when there's a crisis, it usually involves treatment. But part of what we also need to do is really start to promote social-emotional health in universal ways and reduce the number of children who would need additional intervention. So that's part of what our prevention work group is around the table discussing and wanting to push out a conference probably in early next year around best practices related to prevention and looking at more of the universal approaches to promote social-emotional health. As Marty was saying earlier, we know that healthy relationships are essential for social-emotional health. And what does that look like from a best practice standpoint, from a pediatric setting to an educational setting? We know that safe and secure environments are important for kids. So how do we make our environments important enough to be looking at them from a lens of safety? And then, of course, the social-emotional competencies that kids need and being able to teach those social-emotional competencies and have that be a comprehensive approach to that teaching across classrooms and schools and districts. I just want to uplift the work that Sean had mentioned that Greece and Wheatland Chailai are involved in. They have kind of gone out of their educational silo and have reached out to support from the Children's Institute to help look systematically at social-emotional supports across their districts so that they're taking on a new resource to help them look more broadly at what they need to make sure they have that is best practice for universal approaches, things that all kids need to have to be social-emotional healthy, and then maybe what's needed for those that might be at risk that we can prevent further need for treatment, and then certainly addressing the treatment needs.
All right, before I grab another phone call, I just want to follow up on one of the points that Dr. Lustig made. You used the phrase culturally competent care, and one of the things that the report finds is there's still a lack of diversity. The Rochester region's child and adolescent behavioral health workforce reflects low cultural and language diversity overall. Is that fair, Dr. Lustig?
Yeah, I'm probably not the expert on this topic because I think there's a lot of nuances to it. But to, you know, whether you're looking at geographic distribution, economic distribution, ethnic, racial, there's just so many variable needs of the different populations that we serve, and we tend to be more focused on managing at the average than managing the specific.
Okay. And let me ask Dr. Nelms just to kind of follow up on another point in the report. I mean, I recall last fall the National Alliance on Mental Illness Rochester chapter brought in Shamiqua Holdsclaw as their annual speaker, and she was amazing. You know, great. She was essentially the Michael Jordan of basketball on the women's side when I was growing up.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, she was awesome. Right. And but you know, she told a very raw emotional story of her own challenges with mental health and some of her successes as well. But she talked about, you know, growing up in the African-American community where there is a little bit of a taboo, a little bit of a stigma at times when it comes to mental health. And this shows up in your reports. In some African-American and Latino communities, mental illness can be seen as taboo and families might avoid seeking treatment. They're not as comfortable talking about it. Kids with mental illness who've broken the law or who are at risk of hurting themselves as a result of their illness sometimes receive punishment from legal experts with no training in mental health. They cannot recognize mental health issues as well. So you have some of these challenges. Do you see that come up?
Absolutely. I think it's deeply rooted in years of not having access to those supports. And so when you
That could change.
Absolutely. I think that with access becomes a sense of trust among those agencies some collaboration between the community and those who are seeking to support them. And I think cultural competence is, and I think Marty explained this clearly, is not just about race. It's really about understanding the culture that you serve, whatever, however you define that. I happen to be a black male, and because I'm in a school that's predominantly black students, doesn't necessarily make me more knowledgeable than someone who's not a black male. I may have a different cultural connection socially, but when it comes to the medical field or things related to socio-emotional health, I have to be smarter about the issues that are harming my students. And then from that point, I become culturally competent and then better able to serve them. And I think often people associate culture with race, and it's really about understanding the people that you serve and you seek to serve. And that is critically important. But I also think that racial equity is critically important also. But we have to also understand the people that we're trying to support every day.
All right, let me grab another phone call, and this is Eamon in Rochester. Go ahead, Eamon.
Hi, yes. I have a question if any on the panel had heard of the Safe and Supportive Schools Bill, which is working its way through the New York State Assembly. And specifically, there's a part of that bill that addresses the use of long-term suspensions in schools, and they want to reduce it to a maximum of 20 days. And part of the reasoning behind that was because they wanted to force districts to connect students to the services they need, and by having a shorter timeline, it would put some heft behind that. So I'm curious what they think of that approach. And
Thank you, Eamon. Thoughts on that? Sean, are you familiar?
Sure, Anita? Yeah, I am actually. And I know that's a bill that's going through the House right now, but also the draft ESSA. It's also coming out and has some language around suspensions and disciplinary infractions. And so I'm never one to be a proponent of X amount of days as being the key. I think it's an individualized experience. There are some students who can learn a lesson after a day, and there are others who it may require additional time and support for them to re-enter the school setting. So what I am a proponent of is making sure that students aren't being punished, but their behavior is being punished and addressed. And if you focus on the behavior aspect of it, then you're more likely to have that kid or that student not repeat the offense. And so at East, and I'm sure other schools throughout RCSD, I really focus on a restorative practice approach that doesn't talk about suspension or discipline, but really talks about restoring relationships that allow kids to have skills that apply in the neighborhood, in the community, and also within school.
One more question from a listener, Michael on Twitter, in regards to determining social and emotional challenges, wants to know, what about lead paint? Some pediatricians seem reluctant to test and make value judgments based on socioeconomics. That's from Michael. Dr. Lustig, what do you think?
So lead testing is routine. All kids should get it in their specified ages for screening. And I would say that both Rochester in general and the pediatric community in Rochester have been leaders in advocacy for lead screening and lead abatement in ways that few communities across the country can boast. So while we have lots of challenges in Rochester and lots of areas that we need to improve, and lead testing is one where we've actually been pretty strong leaders in that realm. Not that there's not more opportunity to improve.
Sure.
It's an important issue.
Anita, let me turn to you as we get ready to wrap up here and look ahead now, because, again, the work that's been going on has yielded a lot, I think, of information, a lot of chances to collaborate. But what is the most important, what's the headline going forward that you want the community to understand about what our listeners can do to help with this process of better, you know, raising kids and protecting kids in our community when it comes to their social and behavioral health, and what happens next?
I think first of all, it's raising awareness and bringing attention to children's social emotional health, that it's essential, that we need to note it and figure out different ways to approach and address it. I think the other is to build these cross-sector collaborations, partnerships, MOUs, to have those in the education setting connect purposefully with those in the mental health setting, to the pediatric setting. So really building some more systemic ways that can help ease the burden around kids who have needs and those families. I think it's in general for anyone who's listening to learn more about trauma and the prevalence of trauma, the impact of trauma, that's an awareness that we all can have, and it can shift the approach that we take with those around us from, you know, what's wrong with you to how can I help you? Mm-hmm.
Superintendent Nilms, about 30 seconds. What do you want listeners to do?
I definitely want people to become more familiar with the adverse childhood experiences information. You can find it on aces2high.com. Because we know that students who are in communities that don't address the ACEs issues have a high probability of becoming seriously mentally ill or have behavioral needs. And so we need to become more educated as a community and for organizations to think about how they might support students or their own employees who may be experiencing some of those adverse experiences.
Okay, 20 seconds. Dr. Lustig.
Yeah, I'd say no matter who you are, you can make a difference in this space. If you're a parent, you need to learn more about this so you can do a better job for your kids. If you work directly with kids, you need to learn more about it so that you can be effective. And even if you only work with other adults, how we demonstrate care and support for each other in the face of trauma will impact the kids and the community as well.
Well, thanks for the work that you're doing. That's Dr. Martin Lustig, Sean Nilms, Anita Black, all here talking about the Greater Rochester Health Foundation's Commission on Children's Behavioral Health in the Finger Lakes. That work goes on. Thanks to all of you for being here and sharing your expertise with us this hour here.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Thanks. And our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.